Welcome to Career Explorer. It's our podcast that talks to community members in different careers and clues students in to what it takes to be successful on the job. So, if you like helping people and you like helping them communicate better, you might want to consider being a speech therapist. On Career Explorer, I have Amy Bland, speech therapist and owner of Phoenix Speech Therapy here in Harford County. Amy, I want to welcome you to the podcast today.
Thank you so much for that sweet welcome. I appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you being here. And first, I just want to start off, tell me a little bit about yourself and what made you want to be a speech therapist.
Sure, yeah. So I've been practicing for a little bit more than 18 years as a speech language pathologist, and that was not my first career choice.
Okay.
Actually, I'm what you would call a non-traditional student. So when I was in high school, I really wanted to go into the medical field. And I truly believed that the way to do that was to go through a pre-med program and to major in biology. And I knew that I wanted to help people. I've always wanted to help people. So I did that. I went to Western Maryland. It's now called McDaniel.
Right.
And did the bio major. And, you know, things happen for a reason as you move along life. And one of those things that happened to me was I was in, I think it was inorganic or organic chemistry, one of the prerequisites. And try as I might, I could not understand that. That is a foreign language to me. And I applaud all of those people who do understand it and love it, because I could not figure that out for the life of me. And although at the time it was tricky and challenging for me because it basically said, this is not the path for you, it all worked out. So my roommate at the time was a psychology major and said, I really think you would enjoy this. We talk a lot about counseling and child development and adulthood and aging and all sorts of things. And so I switched over to that. So I became a psychology major. My minor was in bio because I had taken so many classes. It kind of was like, why not? And again, I had one of those interesting situations. I had a professor who was teaching psychology of the special needs child and gifted child.
Okay.
And he himself was an audiologist, and he was married to a speech language pathologist, and his children were either audiologist or speech language pathologist. So we covered a lot about the world of speech and hearing and communication, and it really piqued my interest. At the same time, the bulletin boards right outside of that classroom had job openings. Many of us take all sorts of jobs in our early 20s, right?
Yes, we
trying
do.
To figure out things.
Sure.
And there was a position to work with two sisters who were autistic. And I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, I don't know anybody who's autistic at the time. So I did that. They were 6 and 3. And the mom had us doing therapy sessions while she supervised and watched. Now, at the time, we thought it all was psychology-based, and I think some of it was, but looking back, it was speech. It was speech therapy. It was
right. Communication
and play therapy and getting them to express their needs in any way they could. It was using a lot of sign language and gesturing, and that really sealed it for me, that I needed to move in that path. So Western Maryland, McDaniel, to this day, does not offer speech-language pathology. So I really had to take a step back and recognize, do I really want to do this? Because this is going to take a very hard left turn. And it's, you know, more time, more money, et cetera. So I shadowed a speech-language pathologist at Care Rehab, which is in Towson, or used to be. I'm not sure if they still are. And followed her throughout the day. She was a pediatric SLP. I did see one adult patient there, I believe. Anyway, I really enjoyed what she was doing, and I thought, okay, this is where I want to go. So in doing so, the different universities that Maryland has that, you know, offer speech-language pathology are Loyola, Towson, and University of Maryland. So I knew it would be one of those three, and after doing research with them, Loyola was the only university at that time. Now, remember, I've been in the field for a while, but at that time, that would allow me to keep my bachelor's in psychology, take, I think it was 5 prerequisite classes, sit for the GREs, do the interviews, and then I could apply for the graduate program. All the other programs that I had to start over with another bachelor's, another 4 years,
wow,
plus the 2 years. So I was like, nope, we're going Loyola.
Good choice.
It certainly was really important that I did that. When I was at Western Maryland, another thing that I did when I was a biology major, I did an internship with a GI doctor. They wanted me to be a GI tech. So GI standing for gastroenterology.
Right.
So, you know, if you have older relatives or friends, I'm sure you've heard them say that they need to get their annual colonoscopy. Some people get upper endoscopies because they have reflux or things like that. So my job was to assist the doctor by helping him hold the scope, taking biopsies, cauterizing polyps. It was really an amazing internship, and I learned a lot.
Wow.
So I do believe that we all have things that happen in our lives for certain reasons. People come into it, different experiences happen, and you may not know at the time why that's happening, but it all comes together. At least that has been my case. My path has been crooked, but it's been a good crooked.
Right.
So fast forward, let's see, I went to Loyola, did the graduate program there, fell in love with working with adults. I love working with children too, but adults really was what was inspiring for me, helping people who have had a stroke or Parkinson's disease or any other type of brain injury find themselves again, you know, be able to communicate, be able to swallow, be able to think clearly. So within the speech program, you then have to do an externship. And one of those for me was Maryland General at the time. I believe it's now University of Maryland Midtown. And then I fell in love with acute care. So from there, I went to, you have to do a clinical fellowship. We can get into that later. But did that first and then ended up at Upper Chesapeake Hospital for about 14 years. And the beginning part of that was in acute care, then to outpatient, now into private practice. So, you know, my path has been crooked, but it's been a good crooked, like I said.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the way it happens, though, right?
Yes.
Because I think a lot of college students, they tend to have this idea in their head that, you know, it's just going to be a straight path. You know, I'm going to go to college, I'm going to find this and that, and I'm going to lead me from point A to B to C.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you're here in front of me, you're telling me that that's just not always the case. Sometimes you go to different places, you gather different skills, and you bring that home to where you find you need to be.
Exactly. And, you know, looking back on it at the time, there was a lot that went on.
Sure.
But I wouldn't change any of it because it did all work out in the end. And you do. You gain different skills. I think it's very difficult for us to expect that 17-year-old, 18-year-old, even 19 years old, that you really know exactly what it is you want to do. And largely I say that because you just don't have the experiences yet.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And
it's nobody's fault. It's just that's where you are. The one piece of advice that I give my clients as well as my own children is that you have to job shadow, because on paper it's going to look like one thing. But when you actually follow that person and you observe what they do day to day,
yes,
that's going to really let you know.
Yes, yes.
Yes, I want to do this, or it's not what I thought.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You, if you have that firsthand knowledge, you know, you're going to see what that job is like day to day. And that, you know, that's another question I have. You know, what is kind of like that day to day? You know, let's say, okay, that student is considering the career path for speech pathology.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that day look like?
So that's a really broad question. And
right.
I'd say that because one of the things that drew me to speech language pathology, the field, is that it's such a broad field. So you can go that path, you know, receive your credentials, and change job settings frequently and still be able to do that. You know what I mean? So
right.
You could be working in a NICU, you could be working in a school system, a hospital, outpatient, an assisted living, a long-term care, private practice. You could work for an ENT doctor. I mean, there's so many different possibilities. For me, as a private practice speech-language pathologist now, what that looks like is seeing clients one-on-one, having individual sessions with them, meeting them where they are, recognizing that they probably have tried a couple of things by the time they come and see me.
Sure.
And so it's not necessarily a 9-to-5 position, but it could be. Sometimes it's, as a business owner, it's a little bit more than that. It's all day.
I imagine. You've told me some of the things that you've gone through as a business owner.
Yeah.
I'll touch on that in a minute.
That's a little bit different. A hospital SLP usually starts really early in the morning.
Okay.
So they're usually there, probably they're starting their day at 8 a.m. and they're receiving orders from the doctors. The nice thing about acute care is that you don't know what you're going to receive. So if you are somebody that likes change and likes kind of, you know, I'm not sure what's going to be this day and that your day is always going to be different, this might be the path for you. It's also pretty fast. So average length of stay in a hospital is 3 days. So you are seeing that person, you are making recommendations for safe discharge, and then you're probably going to receive another person right after that. So you're not with them long. So it's more of an evaluation type setting. It's a lot of critical thinking, quick thinking, because people are waiting for you to make recommendations.
Right.
Based on, in the hospital, it's mainly swallowing evaluations.
Okay.
Whereas an outpatient, you really get to know that person.
Right.
So you might be with that person with months to a year plus, depending on what they're working on. You're seeing them twice a week, 3 times a week for an hour each. You get to know their families. You get to know their goals. You have more time with them.
Right.
So it depends on the setting. And then in the school setting, because of the number of students that really would benefit from services, a lot of therapy is group therapy. So just to make sure that everyone is receiving therapy, you know, everybody might be working on their R's. So
right.
You have a group of 3 kids and we're all doing the same sort of, you know, activity. We have the same goals and they're listening to those kids and the kids are listening to each other. So the school setting is a little bit different. And of course, the school setting follows the school holidays and so forth. So the benefit there is that, you know, you get your summers off and
right.
snow days off.
There
and
you go.
Whereas in the healthcare world, there are no snow days.
No, there is not. I used to work for optometrists, and trust me, you know, you see patients
mm-hmm.
and you see them. You don't have a snow
come
day.
Come rain or shine, right?
Come rain or shine.
The one setting I forgot was virtual.
Okay.
So that's newer since the pandemic.
Absolutely.
And we do virtual therapy as well. Of course, there's pros and cons.
Sure.
But it's definitely a part of our practice. And I think it's a part of the school community as well as healthcare too. So
that's definitely one of the ways that, you know, not just healthcare, but education
mm-hmm.
kind of adapted during the pandemic.
They had to, right?
You know, it's mm-hmm. got to utilize technology to your benefit. And, you know, virtual now is just kind of, you know, standard thing in today's society.
Agreed.
And mm-hmm. I just want to kind of capitalize a little bit on what you were saying there about, you know, different people, you know, coming from different walks of life, and you're meeting them where they are in life. And there's so many different reasons, though, why a person would need speech
mm-hmm.
therapy. You know, considering, you know, that idea, how do speech therapists, you know, help those in need? People who have had strokes,
mm-hmm.
correct? What are some of the other
sure.
medical conditions?
Sure. So in the adult world, stroke, Parkinson's disease, traumatic brain injury or concussion, anybody that is having difficulty with their swallowing because maybe they have COPD,
okay.
or which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So their breathing is off, so now their swallowing is off because we have a fine coordination with that. We also see a number of adults, children too, but adults with voice difficulties, persistent hoarseness. We see people that have had anterior cervical fusion surgery.
Okay.
And part of that surgery is that it's right near that airway and near the vocal cords and so forth. So sometimes we see some swallowing difficulties or voice difficulties because of that. We do see some people that have primary progressive aphasia, which is a type of dementia.
Right.
And we do see some people that have diagnosed or in the milder stages of dementia, and we help with cognitive communication skills, changing their environment, helping their caregivers to provide a safe environment for them while still promoting independence. So those are probably the top. Every now and again, we'll see somebody that has myasthenia gravis, which is also a neurological condition and can affect their speech and swallowing. We see people that have ALS. It's best if we see somebody with ALS early on when their speech is clear and intact, because what we'll do is do something where we record their voice, and it's called voice banking, and we do a lot of recording. So we'll do what they say all the time, like good morning, or, you know, what are we having for dinner? You know, the two most popular questions.
Sure.
And whatever else that they would say. And we record those because, unfortunately, we know with ALS that it's going to change.
Right.
And the reason we're recording it is we want to put it into what's called an AAC device, or augmentative alternative communication device. So it's like a computer, and in fact, you can do it on an iPad too, but it's like a computer.
Okay.
Where they press a button, it's programmed, customized for them. And then let's say the button was, I'm hungry, I want something to eat, or I want to order a burger. It's in their voice. It's not a computerized voice.
It's their voice. Okay.
Right, right. So we try and work with people early on so that they have that. Versus, I mean, of course you can use a synthesized computer voice, but more people would prefer their own voices.
Sure, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I know I would.
Mm-hmm. So that's on the adult
realm. That's on the adult realm.
On the pediatric realm, probably the biggest area would be any sort of delay in speech and language. Maybe your child is walking fine, but they don't have many words, and they're getting a little bit older, and they're starting to get frustrated because they can't express their needs.
Right.
So we can help with that, of course. We see many, many, many children, all different ages, that aren't pronouncing their sounds correctly and clearly. My sister and I both went to speech therapy, as an FYI, when we were kids.
Okay.
So I went for speech sound production. She had a lateral lisp. So, you know, a lot of us benefit from speech therapy. And certainly we work with different populations as well. We work with autistic children. We work with Down syndrome children, cerebral palsy, any child that is nonverbal for whatever reason. And our job is to make sure that they can communicate clearly what they want. So we're always advocating for the child or the client, you know, whoever that is. We also work with pediatric feeding and swallowing. So my son, actually my youngest, had a lot of allergies when he was younger. He was allergic to milk, believe it or not.
Okay. All right.
And that was really rough, and became a very picky eater due to that, because of his allergies. So, you know, we work with the sensory piece and the feeding piece and trying to explore other foods in a very structured manner. So that's a different area. And then with regards to, I guess you would say really any age, but we're seeing a big uptick in middle school, high school, college age students who are having a difficult time kind of transitioning back into the face-to-face world of school.
Sure.
And we provide executive functioning or executive function coaching, I should say, for any student that's having difficulty. So maybe they just have some difficulty with those executive function skills of, okay, I know what I need to do, but I don't know when I should be doing it, right? So I know I need to do my homework, but I don't really remember when it's due, and and I forgot to, you know, submit it. So now I have an NHI or not handed in, and now it's snowballing, and, you know, that can be overwhelming.
Yeah, and it just adds up from there sometimes.
Yes. And then, of course, students that have ADD or ADHD, most likely this is going to be an area that's challenging for them, and our job is to advocate for them to be as independent as possible, to promote that independence, but we're going to support them initially, and then we're going to start to back off.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You let them grow and grow, and then you let
them
take flight.
We start to fade.
Right,
yeah.
And
we also work with people that have had a concussion. So they actually, someone who's had a concussion and then has cognitive difficulties can be very challenging because, first of all, you can't see the injury, right? So it's hidden. And secondly, there's a number of people that have had a concussion that don't really want to let other people know that they're struggling in this because they want to go back on the field or the court or wherever. And, you know, our job is to get you back on there and get you back to learning and back to doing what you were doing. But it might take a little bit because it is a brain injury. It's a mild traumatic brain injury, but it is a brain injury, and it needs to be addressed. Oftentimes what we see is somebody having some dizziness first, and they may have some sensitivities to light and noise and so forth. And the old school method was to keep that person in a quiet, dark place for like a month. And that is not what's recommended now.
I was going to say.
No.
Things have changed.
Yes, thankfully. So, you know, normally it depends on the doctor, depends on the severity of the concussion, right? But it's only, you know, a couple days that, you know, they're really taking it easy. And then they want you to kind of get back to where you were. Most people cannot start cognitive therapy with us until the dizziness has been resolved or their headaches or, you know, some of those really obvious physical symptoms. And then once that is passed or they're in a better spot, then we will start working with them and working on attention and focus and memory. Memory tends to be the big one, the working memory.
So it really is a lot of meeting people where they are. So you kind of have to play detective in many often ways just to try to find where this person is. How can I now help them at this stage where they're at, given whatever kind of impairment or disability that they may present to you.
So that's a good point. Yeah, it is. It's critical thinking skills, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's really something I think that is something that we're really pushing to our students nowadays is critical thinking. Mm-hmm. Being able to analyze a situation and knowing that there's not a cookie cutter,
right?
You know, when you're dealing with people. And this is a people intensive job.
Oh, yes, it is. You got to love people. You don't.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a big numbers person, but I love people all day long. So this is definitely the type of position that, you know, you should come from it from an empathetic view, right?
Exactly.
But you should also have that kind of desire to like, let me see if I can figure this puzzle out, because it is. It's kind of like a puzzle, and being aware of, oh, maybe I've seen this before, maybe I'll try this. But it's also understanding you may have very specific goals because you think that would be helpful for that person, but that person might come back and say to you, no, I don't want to work on that. I want to work on this. And so you have to be able to shift. And you know, because it's their goals.
And you're right. As a therapist, you have to get the feedback from your patient, and you have to meet them where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
So very people intensive.
Yes.
And if I might, you know, just point out, you're an excellent people person.
Oh, well, thank you.
I mean, I would feel totally at ease, you know.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And I have to ask this because this is a big question. Let's say I'm that student who wants to become a speech therapist. What are those fields of study that I should be enrolling into, and how much education is it going to take for me to become this role?
So you want to have either an undergraduate in speech-language pathology, and like I said, there's those three schools I mentioned earlier, Loyola, Towson, University of Maryland, in Maryland, that offer those programs. It is a bachelor's. It is 4 years. There are some programs out of state that do like a communication studies that has speech in it. They're a little bit harder to find because they really have to meet some rigorous requirements from the National Board. Okay. So it would be best to do the speech language pathology undergraduate major as your bachelor's. You certainly could go my route and, you know, do biology and psychology together, and then it will take you longer, of course. But it depends on, you know, where you're leaning towards. The straightest route is the speech language pathology undergraduate. Then all of us have to have our master's. So then that's an additional 2 years full-time at a program that offers a graduate program. And the three schools I mentioned, they do.
Okay.
There's many nationally. And within those 2 years, you will be doing an internship. So you'll be seeing some clients within the university that they provide to you with a supervisor. And then your second year, you will be doing an externship where you are going off-site. Usually, one half of the year, it's with pediatrics, and the other half of the year, it's with adults. So that ends up being in the school and at some sort of like hospital-based or private practice. So that when you, you know, graduate, you have had some experience. Then once you graduate, you have to apply for what's called a clinical fellowship.
Okay.
That is a paid position, but you have to find another speech-language pathologist that will be your supervisor for 9 months.
Okay.
And that supervising SLP has to sign off on all your notes. So you have your own caseload of people, and you're seeing them, but that speech-language pathologist is likely going to observe you. They're going to sit in with you. They're your mentor. They're the person you are discussing cases with and treatment plans and so forth. When you finish that clinical fellowship, you then send in the paperwork to our national board, which is the American Speech and Hearing Association, better known as ASHA. ASHA says, fantastic, good job, congratulations. And you're awarded something called your C's. So what that means is you have completed your certificate of competence. And what that says to anyone is that you are independent. You can go where you want. You don't need to be supervised anymore. So it's a big deal. So that's how it goes.
That's the nutshell
yes.
version of it. But, and it's, it, I love what you mentioned about encouraging shadowing someone,
mm-hmm.
because isn't that just one of the best ways that
absolutely.
You learn is by being on the job,
mm-hmm.
you know, by shadowing someone, and that way you get the day-to-day,
mm-hmm.
you know. And one of the things that we always promote to our students here is internships.
Yes.
Internships. Intern early and intern often,
mm-hmm.
because that really is one of the best ways,
mm-hmm.
you know, to get ahead, you mm-hmm. know, and to get a head start on the career.
Yeah, and there is a portion when you are, let me think about this. I think it's between your undergraduate and your graduate year, somewhere in between there, you do have to have 30 observation hours.
Okay.
So the school pushes hard because they don't want you to sign up for this program and you don't really know what it entails.
I remember something, because you're an old friend of WHFC. You've been here in our studios before, and you said something that stuck to me, and you said that you really do think that there's growth for more speech therapists, right?
Oh, 100%.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about that. I mean, and just as a feeling, I mean, I'm not, you know, looking at hardball numbers, but, you
mm-hmm.
know, talking to someone who's in the field,
mm-hmm.
I remember you saying, we need more speech therapists.
We do. We absolutely do. I can tell you the school system certainly needs more speech language pathologists. You know, anyone that has been watching with the schools on the news, or you're a parent or student, it's been a rough couple past years with the pandemic
sure.
and so forth. And, you know, many people have changed careers, many people have changed settings, but the school system desperately needs some help with managing the caseloads and making sure that the children are receiving the services that they deserve, quite frankly. With regards to the other settings, I can tell you this past week, I've seen 5 different job posts in the larger hospital systems. So they're all looking. A number of my friends that are private practice owners, they're posting job positions. So it's certainly a field that very much needs speech language pathologist. And like I said before, I think it's a great field in that you can start in one setting and then after a number of years move to another setting. You're not going to, you don't have to burn out in one setting, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
And you can kind of find your niche or your specialty a couple times.
And that's a good thing too. Mm-hmm. You know, being able to move around an occupation, you know, mm-hmm. laterally, you know,
yes.
trying different parts of the occupation, because there's many different facets of mm-hmm. of speech therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But you also mentioned, you know, owning your own practice, and I know that you are the operator for Phoenix Speech Therapy, and talk to me a little bit about that. I mean, if I'm a speech pathologist, do I need to have my own practice? Is there a benefit, I guess, to owning my own practice?
Sure. So that is its own field in itself.
Yeah.
You know, let's justify that. And you had mentioned, you know, on the job training. Yes, that is me every day.
Okay.
But I'm a lifelong learner. I enjoy learning. So it's the business piece of it is not taught to you in graduate school. What you receive when you leave graduate school is a really thorough clinical training. So you are prepared as a clinician. In the private practice field, you do not have to have a private practice to be a speech language pathologist. And actually, I would be of the mindset to tell you, wait a little bit. And the reason I say wait a little bit is because it is its own field of study that you need to understand and learn. And if you're a brand new clinician, you are still gaining experience with patients and clients. And if you were to open your own private practice, many people open it like I did as a solo provider. So you're the only provider, right?
Sure.
You want to have a good confidence level with your clinical skills, because you don't know who's coming to you in private practice.
Sure.
Right? Now, certainly we have a code of ethics that we follow. And if somebody came to you and you had just opened a private practice and you did not feel comfortable treating stuttering, let's just say that, you shouldn't take that person. Just because they are a new person for you and you're thinking, oh, this would be good for my business, ethically, you shouldn't take them, because you don't have the skill set.
Right.
Right. You should refer them to someone else.
Right.
So I think it would be wise to have a couple of years under your belt, probably like 3 to 5, before entertaining the idea of a private practice. Now, that doesn't mean you can't start to plan for it, because there's a lot of planning that needs to happen.
Sure.
You just don't press the go button just yet.
Not yet.
Yeah.
You know, wait to pull, you mm-hmm. know, the trigger on that.
Mm-hmm.
But I hear what you're saying, you know, and it definitely sounds like there's other life skills,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you should have, mm-hmm. you know, and business for one,
yes.
you know, especially if you are going to, you know, have your own practice. But on that note, just to kind of forward that a little bit, what other life skills would you recommend that a student, and
yeah.
maybe not just a speech therapist
in general,
but even in general,
yeah.
what would you
yeah.
recommend for a new speech therapist for other skills?
Sure. Well, I think it's really important that you have really strong people skills and social skills and those kind of soft topics. You know, unfortunately or fortunately, however you want to look at it, we now have this virtual world, right? And with that, some things have been lost, such as knowing when to give good eye contact, having a strong or firm handshake, knowing sense of time, right? Being punctual or a little bit earlier for appointments, knowing sense of time too. So like when you are interviewing with someone or you're speaking to someone, being respectful of their time, understanding the passage of time. It's interesting, you know, and there's a lot of research that supports this, but in the digital world, you know, if you are doing what's considered a preferred task, right? So is that a video game or TikTok or Facebook or whatever, time just seems to float away, right? Yeah. Because you're doing something that you just love and there's no sense of time. That's an important thing to be aware of, right?
Time management.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, yeah. Organization, being able to know when things are planned, whether that's using a calendar or a planner, whether it's digital, whether it's using an app like Structured. There's so many different things, but having some sort of consistent system. And I think planning. Planning's a big one.
Yes.
And not just saying, my plan is to be a speech-language pathologist. That's my plan. Okay. If you were working with me, I would say, well, how are you going to get there? Right? So let's plan backwards. What resources do you need? How long do you think it's going to take? How long is each task going to take? How hard do you think this is going to be? So asking some of those questions to put you on a good path to succeed. And I think that's part of learning to become a clinician. So if I meet you and you say to me, you know, my husband had a stroke and I really want him to be able to communicate clearly to me because I can't understand what he's saying. Okay. So maybe the long-term goal is that he communicates it clearly and effectively. My job as a clinician is now to break it down into short-term objectives or goals for us to get there. So if you want to be a speech-language pathologist, that is part of your training.
Okay.
So that kind of mirrors that life skill of planning for anything.
Amy, I got to be honest with you. You have given me so much good information here. I think I want to become a speech therapist.
Come on board.
All right, where do I sign up? If you're considering a career being a speech therapist, well, here you go. This is something to think about. I really, before we leave, Amy, mm-hmm. I just want to ask you, is there anything that you want to say to that student who is considering the career path? What is your best advice?
Yeah, so my best advice is to shadow. And if you'd like to shadow at my private practice, I would be more than happy to offer that for you because I do. I think that's necessary and priceless. So, you know, certainly look us up, phoenixspeechtherapy.net. You can ask to speak to me directly or you can speak to our office manager and we'll get you set up so you can observe some clients, of course, as long as the clients are willing. And I would say 99.9% of them are.
Great.
But yeah, I think that that's the number one piece of advice is go out there, observe, see what people are doing to see, does this fit with what your plan is and what your goal is?
I want to thank my guest today, Amy Bland of Phoenix Speech Therapy, for coming on to Career Explorer. Amy, thanks so much.
Oh, of course. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to have you back again.
Of course.
You've been on the Career Explorer podcast. Please like and subscribe to all three of Hartford Community College's official podcasts, Feedback, HCC 360, and WHFC Presents, so you know when new content drops. For Career Explorers, I'm Matt Terry. See you next time.